by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. On the program today, a conversation with writer Lori Lynn Drummond. She was a police officer for 8 years, and her first book is a collection of short stories that portray the lives of five female cops working in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. It's titled, Anything You Say Can and Will Be Used Against You. This is from the book's description. In prose as unflinching and nuanced as the job itself, each woman's story, like each call in a police officer's day, varies in its singular drama, but all the tales illuminate the tenuous line between life and death, violence and control, despair and salvation. The book has drawn rave reviews from writers including Elmore Leonard and Joseph Wambaugh. He says, quote, her stories sizzle. Listeners, I invite your telephone calls this afternoon. You can join the conversation with your questions and comments. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else in the U.S., call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Lori Lynn Drummond's fiction has appeared in journals, including Southern Review, Fiction, and Story. She's a former uniformed officer with the Baton Rouge Police Department. Today, she makes her home in Austin, Texas, where she is an assistant professor of writing at St. Edward's University. Drummond is about halfway through a 25-city book tour, and later this month, she'll be in Chicago. On the 24th of this month, 2004, she'll be at Barbara's Books for a reading and signing. That's set for 7:30 p.m. Again, that date, March 24th, 2004. Anything You Say Can and Will Be Used Against You is published by HarperCollins. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Lori Drummond, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
A pleasure to be talking with you, Celeste.
What led you into and out of law enforcement?
Well, what led me into it was I was in college in upstate New York, and I needed a job. And I went looking for the highest paying job on campus, which was dishwasher, and I lasted about 2 days. And then I went on to the next highest paying job on campus, which was an organization called SASP, the Student Auxiliary Security Patrol. And they were kind of an adjunct eyes and ears to the police department on campus. We worked from 7 in the evening until 3 in the morning in teams of two. They gave us walkie-talkies and keys to all the buildings on campus and badges and flashlights. And I just got really drawn in by having access to information and events that the average person didn't have. Also, the adrenaline of helping people.
Yeah, and the drama of it all, I would imagine.
Yes, yes. You know, at that point, the kinds of things that I would work would be first aid calls or fights. We worked a lot of parties, a lot of crowd control for concerts and football games. But it was that sense of helping, that sense of being on the line and possibly there in a life and death situation that just I found very intoxicating.
But then you got out of it.
But then I got out of it. I left police work about 9 years later, partly because I was getting burnt out. There were a lot of veteran officers who were leaving the police department. There were a lot of problems within the department and within the city at that time. I wanted to get transferred off the streets because I knew I was getting burnt out. I couldn't because we were so short-handed. I couldn't quite figure out what an ex-cop with a couple of years of theater was going to do, you know, in terms of a career for the rest of her life. And then I got in a very bad wreck on duty, and I was in rehab for about 15 months. And I decided, well, this is this is the signal that I really do need to go ahead and leave the police department altogether.
Yeah. Well, I have a relative by marriage who was on the police force in Chicago for 30-some years, and I don't know, I don't know how he did it. You know, in one of the stories in Anything You Say, there's a scene where some rookies and some veterans are talking about why one would want to be a cop.
Mm-hmm.
And one of these guys says, one of the veterans says, doing good and helping people is crap. Let me tell you, all we do out here is answer calls, cover our asses, and try not to get hurt. Why do people stay in for so many years, do you think?
Because there is that reward in terms of both, quote, catching the bad guys. There also, I think, a lot of officers become addicted to the adrenaline and the power. I think for many officers, they can't figure out how to get out. If they want, you know, if they're thinking of getting out, they can't figure out what they would do. It's a very secure job. You don't generally lose your job unless you've done something wrong. It's not as though they are downsizing police departments. I think that a lot of people truly love what they do despite how hard the job is.
Mm. That story that I mentioned, Catherine's Elegy, packs a lot of suspense and a lot of drama. It really had me all worked up.
Thank you.
Now, when you write a story like that, when you write these stories, do you feel the adrenaline?
Oh, yes. I return to that time. I almost, it's like inhabiting the character for me, and I feel the uniform, I feel the gun belt. It's like I'm a police officer again. So it's pretty hard and often very traumatic for me to go back to that and write that closely to my experiences at that time.
Yeah. The first protagonist we meet in this collection of stories is a woman by the name of Katie Joubert, and confronted with a suspect who makes a move toward her with the intent to kill her, she shoots. Then she turns around and works to save his life.
Mm-hmm.
And in another story involving this character, taste, touch, sight, sound, smell, she speaks of the holy and the horrible.
Mm-hmm.
What a great way to put it. How the holy and the horrible comes to penetrate every corner of a cop's life.
Oh, absolutely. There really is that polarity at work. And I think if you're lucky enough to be aware of that, that can make the job much easier for you. I think that a lot of police work is dealing with polarity. You can go out on a horrific call, and there's something very funny about it. It's similar to, I hear a lot of people talk about how at funerals, there's a lot of grief, but there's a lot of laughter, too. There are a lot of funny things that happen. And so I think for police officers, you know, that polarity is constantly at work. I don't know of many police officers. I'll go out on a limb here. I would say that 99% of police officers don't want to kill anyone. I think there's about 1% who shouldn't be in the job, are probably psychologically not fit for it. But the other 99%, none of us want to have to shoot or kill anyone. And it has a great impact on an officer when that happens.
Yeah. There's a passage in this story where Katie reveals some of the details of her childhood and how she enjoyed the thrill of detection. What would you like to say about Katie and what led her to police work?
I think Katie, the curiosity, that particular part in that story is very much drawn from my own experience, which was the desire to figure things out, to have all the information. And I think that's a basic characteristic for a lot of police officers, is we want to have as much information as possible to figure things out, whether it's how to control this particular situation, whether it's how to talk to this particular person, whether it's how to put together a report that will hold up in court, you know, anything like that. I think it's a very basic characteristic of police officers. We're very curious. We want to know what's going on. We like to be challenged in that way. And so for Katie, that's very integral to her personality.
Yeah. Do you see similarities between the work police officers do and the work writers do?
Actually, I do. I think that, and if I can expand that, I see a relation between teaching and theater as well, all four of which I've done, which is you're basically trying to convince a group of people or a person to do or to believe or to learn or act the way you want them to. So there's a great similarity in terms of your own tone and presence, how you are manipulating, and I mean that in a positive way, how you are manipulating the words and the environment for the desired effect.
Mm. It's about engagement.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's also about compassion, I think. I think it's about empathy, understanding who your audience is, understanding who this person is, excuse me, who's standing in front of you, whether it's a suspect, whether it's a victim, putting yourself in their shoes briefly to figure out the best way to negotiate the most positive outcome you can.
Well, you're always observing.
Yes.
Intuition is critical.
Yes.
You're always questioning.
Yes.
And police officers, there's a line in one of the stories, police officers have to think like criminals. But, you know, writers get to think like all kinds of people, don't they?
Yes, we do, which is kind of fun. You know, we get to inhabit lots of different personalities and perspectives, prejudices. It is a fascinating kind of work.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. A couple of years ago, I interviewed two former Chicago police officers, and they are writers now today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know what, if I'm recalling correctly, I think that there's a group or an association of current and former police officers who are writers.
I'm not aware of that. I will need to check that out. I'm not familiar with that organization at all.
I'll go back and research that, and I'll send you an email or
something.
That
would be fun I would enjoy learning about that and contacting them.
Yeah, it was a very interesting discussion. Two police officers, one who served a long time on the force and the other who served, I'm going to say, maybe half a dozen years.
Uh-huh.
And one of the interesting things we talked about is how it's also a family thing. You know, isn't that interesting that it seems to be hardwired in some folks' families. I mean, the older gentleman who I talked with, I think he had two of three sons on the force.
Wow. That sounds very similar to the Baton Rouge Police Department, where you've got very often a mother, a father, some cousins, maybe some siblings, and then, 20 years later, you've got their kids on the department. So I think that's fairly common in most police departments, partly because the kids have grown up around police work and learn to respect the job and see it as honorable, and also probably go into it with their eyes a little more open because, excuse me, they know the difficulties of the job as well.
Hmm. Writer Lori Lynn Drummond is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of a collection of stories recently published, Anything You Say Can and Will Be Used Against You. The publisher is HarperCollins. She has, she's now about halfway through a long book
tour. Very long
book tour. I think you're in Seattle today.
I am in Seattle today. I think I'm on City 14 or 15. I've kind of lost count.
Later this month, she'll be in Chicago. On Wednesday evening, the 24th of March this year, 2004, she'll be at Barbara's Books for a reading and signing. That's set for 7:30 p.m. Lori Lynn Drummond is a former uniformed officer with the Baton Rouge Police Department. Today she makes her home in Austin, where she's an assistant professor of writing at St. Edward's University. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, as long as we're talking about, cities and this huge tour that you're on. You know, you've lived in Ithaca, Baton Rouge, Austin, and you grew up in Virginia?
I did. I was actually born in Bryan, Texas. My daddy was an Aggie, for which I forgive him. And we moved when I was 10 months old to Massachusetts, and then when I was 3 and a half, we moved to La Jolla, California. And then when I was almost 6, we moved to Northern Virginia, the Fairfax area, which is where I grew up and graduated from high school, and then went off to college in upstate New York in Ithaca.
Wow. All kinds of different landscapes, all kinds of cities with different personalities.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah. I wonder, how do police departments differ place to place?
That's all right. I think there are differences that come from the police chief, that come from the community that's being served, will have something to do with the political landscape of the community. If it's a more activist, liberal community, you're going to have a different kind of police department than a very conservative, homogeneous kind of community. But that said, I think that across the board, there is a similarity in the police culture within police departments. I've been talking to police officers across the country, and I'm hearing the same kind of thing, which is, you know, you're telling our stories. You got it right. So clearly it doesn't matter whether these stories are set in Baton Rouge. They're applying just as much to Bellingham, Washington, and Portland, and Nashville, Tennessee. So,
yeah. What kind of stories do cops like to tell one another?
We generally tell really funny stories. And they may have these elements of pathos or sadness or danger, but generally it's a real twist on funny, you know. It's approaching it from a very humorous standpoint. Like one of the stories I'm often asked to tell again is about the time I got shot by a dog, and it was a call that I went out on. We found out later, it was a setup, a calculated ambush on a police officer. But the short version is, I got attacked by a dog. The dog's chewing down on my leg. I didn't want to shoot the dog because I was afraid I was going to miss and shoot myself instead. And so I shot into the ground. And when I put out the call for help on the radio, I said, I've been shot by a dog, because I was flustered enough.
Oh,
and there were people from all over the city responding to see this dog that had shot me. So we tell those kinds of stories. You know, it was scary at the time.
Yeah.
I'm lucky that, you know, the dog didn't get me down on the ground. I'm lucky that the gunshot into the ground worked, you know, all those things. But we put a funny spin on it.
Wow. Man, that's a good story.
I have another good story.
Yeah?
I have lots of good stories, like the police officer who was a motorcycle officer got in a wreck. This was like November, December, so for Louisiana, it was cold. And he clearly needed to go to the hospital, but he kept refusing. And finally, his supervisor ordered him into the ambulance, and he was like, Lieutenant, you don't understand. I can't go to the hospital. They're going to cut my pants off me, and I'm wearing pantyhose underneath. He was mortified that everybody would discover he was wearing pantyhose to keep warm.
Yeah.
So those are the kinds of stories that we tell.
Well, pantyhose are a really nice, inexpensive way to keep warm.
Yeah, but this is a pretty macho cop who didn't want to be discovered
pantyhose. I don't blame him. I wouldn't either. You know, as I mentioned in my introduction, this collection of stories is receiving very nice attention. And Library Journal, in a starred review, notes that you succeed in the demands of the short story, conveying quickly a sense of place, character, and plot. You're now working on a novel. How's it coming along?
It took me probably 4 or 5 months of flailing around trying to figure out how to write a novel. And all my friends who've written novels said, oh, yeah, you're doing it right. You should be flailing around. And I thought, well, this is an awful way to write. I'm doing better. I have about 100 pages now, and I have a better sense of, for me, writing is almost a body thing. I feel the pace. I feel the structure and the arc of a story. I know it's time to stop this scene, move on to the next. Now we need exposition. So for me, I really had to, and I'm still struggling with that, what does a novel feel like? Where do you need to speed up? Where do you need to slow down? In terms of working with chapters, everyone said, well, just think of each chapter as a short story. Well, that doesn't work for me. I almost have to think in a larger sense of sections, and then the chapters are these smaller, interconnected scenes. Yeah. So it's been a very interesting process to kind of learn how to do it.
Yeah, there's a lot more time and more space in a novel.
Yes, which can be dangerous because you think, oh, well, you know, I can slow down and go off here and go off there, and I was beginning to realize, all right, my pace has gotten too slow.
Let's talk with a listener. A caller in Eureka is waiting to talk with us on line four. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Two short questions, please. Could you, in your own way, and I believe it would be certainly because you are a female, are there different ways in which male and female officers operate and generally handle situations in your mind?
Yes, and again, I'm generalizing, but in general, female police officers will try and handle any situation first verbally. We tend to have stronger verbal skills anyway, in general, than men, and so we use that. That is one of our primary tools to avoid any kind of physical confrontation, whereas men, again, in general, tend to come into a scene with a great amount of physicality. I mean, they're really presenting themselves physically, and that's generally what you get first.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Second question, what in your mind, and again, you probably would be generalizations, but backed by your experience, would you see the greatest misperceptions, misunderstandings the general public have about police?
I think there's probably two answers to that question. I think the first one is I often hear how mean or tough or unsmiling or gruff or arrogant or, you know, I hear all these terms used about police officers and interactions with police officers. And very often it's with traffic stops or traffic wrecks or what civilians tend to view as low-key, non-threatening types of calls. And I think what the general public doesn't realize is that, number one, more police officers are killed or injured on traffic stops or working wrecks than any other call. Mm-hmm. We don't know who we're about to stop. This person could have just robbed a bank. This person could have just, you know, killed someone, and it's not in the computer yet. We are taught to suspect everyone, and in order to survive, we have to be hyper-alert, and in order to be hyper-alert, you can't be as soft and as gentle and as warm as you might want to be. So I think that's one of the misperceptions. I think the other thing is that it's a very hard job to do, and when people don't like you, and in general, a lot of people tend not to like the police simply because they're the police and they're the authority figure and, you know, I got a speeding ticket kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. When people don't like you to constantly deal with that day after day after day, it's really exhausting, mm-hmm. really exhausting, and it makes the job so hard.
I can see that. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other telephone calls are invited. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else in the U.S., you can call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest this afternoon, Lori Lynn Drummond. She is a former uniformed officer with the Baton Rouge Police Department. Today, she lives in Austin, Texas, where she's an assistant professor of writing at St. Edward's University. She is the author of Anything You Say Can and Will Be Used Against You. It's a collection of stories. It's published by HarperCollins. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Again, the telephone number is 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Well, back to the characters that are in this book. They're women police officers, the main characters. They number five. How are they similar to one another, and how are they different from one another?
They're similar to each other in the ways they try and navigate between the law and their own ethical, moral territory, that fine line between adherence to the law and what they believe is compassionate or correct for themselves, for the job. I think they're also very similar in that they like their work, they believe in their work, they may be scarred by it. I think they're all scarred by it, but they see it as an honorable profession, and they are trying to be good police officers. The way they're different is the way we're all different. We all have our own history and past experiences that influence how we see the world, how we react to situations, how we approach people, relationships. You know, Catherine, the first character, is very happily married to a police officer, whereas the very last character in the story, Sarah, is clearly using relationships and sex as a way to kind of dull the pain of what she's seen. She has a very hard time committing to any relationship. Keeps it very superficial. And then you've got Mona, mm-hmm. who is married to a police officer, but her father was a police officer. She comes out of an abusive household. She's becoming abusive herself. So it's their individual personalities and histories that vary.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Good afternoon. For the author, during your time on the job, what was the dumbest criminal you ever encountered? this is from Jay Leno, actually, on The Tonight Show. He reads stories about dumb criminals, so I thought I'd ask one.
You know, there's so many. They blur into one. The dumbest criminal. I guess my favorite one is this is when I was working plainclothes at LSU Police, and a young woman came in who'd been raped, and we went back to the location where she'd been raped, and the guy's ID was lying on the ground. That was the easiest case to solve and probably one of the stupider moves I'd ever seen. But, you know, people do so many dumb things in many ways that I really couldn't pick out one besides that.
That's a good one.
Okay. Thanks for the question.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. I remember a case in Urbana a number of years ago. This was quite a long time ago, where a man held up a bank and he went back a couple days later to open up an account.
I've heard that.
Honest to God, it happened.
So. Yes, you have to love their naivete.
Yeah.
It makes our job as police officers much easier.
Yeah. Are any of these characters in this book the tiniest bit autobiographical?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. Two of the stories that are the most autobiographical, one is Finding a Place, which is about a fatality wreck that a police officer works, where she basically holds a young man's head together. That's pretty much word for word a wreck that I worked. Taste, touch, sight, sound, smell comes out of my own experiences of, you know, my going through the police academy, what I learned as I came out onto the streets, how I taught rookies. A lot of it's pulled from my own childhood. So those two pieces are pretty autobiographical. The others, for instance, the first story about Catherine, Katie Joubert, fortunately, I never killed anyone. But I came very close. We went out on a burglary in progress and had confirmation from the owner that there was someone inside who should not be. We entered the building, and a man came around the corner and would not stop, even when we ordered him to stop. And it appeared that he had something in his hands, and I literally pulled the gun up at the last second. The bullet went into the ceiling right where it meets the wall when he stepped enough into the light that we could see that what he was carrying actually was black gloves. But so that first story comes out of my imagining what would it have been like if I'd killed someone, although it's through Katie's experience. A lot of the stories jump off from my thinking about what if this had happened or a crime scene photograph that I had seen.
Yeah. That close call you had.
Yes.
I can't imagine. It's so hard for me to imagine having to make that decision whether to shoot or not. But then also, just even coming close must have been quite an experience. It must have hung with you for a long time.
Oh, it did. And I think the thing that I disliked the most was, excuse the term, but I was gun shy for several weeks afterwards on calls. You know, just I remember thinking, if somebody comes out with a gun, I probably will get killed because I'm going to hesitate. And that really concerned me, and then I kind of got over it. But we did a lot of training, and I know a lot of police departments do this, called Shoot, Don't Shoot, and I helped train officers and put them through these different scenarios where you open a door, the lights are off, you push them inside, and they've got to handle this situation, and there's always going to be a gun involved, and they've got to decide whether to shoot or not. So you get a lot of training around that, but when it actually happens to you, it's very sobering.
Yeah. And how do you talk with your partner about that kind of a situation, or is it something you don't talk about?
The way we've talked about it, because I'm still I was teamed up with another woman for almost 2 years. We were the first uniformed team out of our precinct, and we're still good friends. I talk with her regularly, and when we talk about it, it's just, you remember that call over on College Drive? Yeah, my God, we were lucky. Yeah, you were lucky. Yeah, there was something. It sure looked like there was something in his hands. We don't go into it any deeper than that.
Mm.
It's just, you know, we just don't.
Sounds like there's a shorthand.
There is. It's enough that she was there. There were actually two other officers there. They were there. They thought the same thing. You know, I think it would have been harder if I'd been by myself. I probably would have done a lot more second guessing as to, was I reading the scene correctly?
Yeah. Today, given budgetary constraints, how common are single officer units?
Most departments I know of have single officer units. They're only teamed up if they're training a rookie, if someone's unit is broken, if they've called out double shifts because of whatever, security concerns, or, you know, there's something going on in the city where they need more officers out. We went to single officer units the last 2 years I was on the department, and that was back in the mid-80s.
Wow.
Even on dog shift, even on the night shift.
Hmm. You know, thinking about the years that you were working in law enforcement, you were a dispatcher in Ithaca in the late 70s, then a plainclothes officer at LSU from 78 to 81, and a uniformed officer with the Baton Rouge City Police Department from the early 80s to the mid 80s. And as you mentioned, you and your friend were the first women teamed together. You know, police departments during this era were recruiting women, but women were still, I would imagine, few in number. What were those years like for women officers?
I was fortunate in that Baton Rouge Police Department had an unusually high number of women for a police department that hadn't, you know, had any women. It was kind of an abnormality to find a department with that high of a percentage. I think that we were about 7 or 8% of the department was female. And there were enough women who'd come on the job in the mid-70s who were ahead of me, so they could act as role models and mentors, just simply by the fact that they were there, mm-hmm. and that I knew that what they'd gone through was a lot harder than what I was going through. For any police officer coming out of the academy, no matter what their gender or racial background or sexual orientation, you've got to prove yourself. For women, you have to work a lot harder to prove yourself, even today. From what I understand, all the women I talk to, you're used very often to fulfill a statistic. I was talking to a police officer in Salt Lake City last week, and she said she'd just been moved into K-9. She was the first female in K-9, and she knew it was to fulfill, you know, a quota. We need a woman in here. And she said, I'm not worried about it. I'm going to prove to them that I can do it just as well as men. So for a lot of women, that's the attitude that you have to survive.
Mm. Lori Lynn Drummond is our guest this afternoon. She's a writer. She's a former uniformed police officer. She's the author of a collection of stories, Anything You Say Can and Will Be Used Against You. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name's Celeste Quinn. Listeners, we have a few minutes remaining in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine, so if you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, in addition to the novel that you're working on, a memoir. Is it important for you to have a couple of things going at the same time?
Yes. If I get stuck with the novel or with a short story, to be able to go to nonfiction or work on an article or do a book review, that helps. I believe it's very important to write every day, except when I'm on book tour. to put myself in front of the computer, it's a job. Mm. And if I get stuck in with one project, then I just move to another project. I'm finding that some of my stories and my experiences play out better in nonfiction than they do in fiction. I mean, it's very interesting how it really seems to separate itself out. Oh, this is fiction. This needs to be nonfiction. I think because fiction is a lot more concerned with character, and nonfiction is a lot more concerned with ideas and exploration. So when I've got a topic that I really want to dig into and figure out what is it that I think, I'll go to nonfiction.
That's interesting. Because, you know, this is something that I wanted to ask you about. A list of your publications includes some works of nonfiction, creative nonfiction.
Mm-hmm,
how would you describe creative nonfiction? And maybe you would tell us a little bit about your work in that genre.
Creative nonfiction uses the devices of fiction, setting, scene, details, dialogue, pacing, all of those things, showing as much as telling, all of those things, and starts really, creative nonfiction starts with feeling, whereas journalism starts with the facts, whereas fiction starts with the imagination or a character. Creative nonfiction then uses these elements, these techniques of fiction, not the storytelling, not the imagination, to devise a narrative about something that has actually happened. So, for instance, one of the pieces that I'm working on right now is called Cops, Closets, and Cockroaches. And it's a series of very funny anecdotes about my experiences with cockroaches, because when I moved down from upstate New York, I had been taught that, you know, if you had cockroaches, it meant you had a dirty house, and they were the little cockroaches. And I came to South Louisiana, and they're, like, so big, and they fly, and they're not afraid of the light, and they fly at you, and they make this wild noise. And I actually took a car door off once because of a cockroach flying down my shirt. They're just gross. So I have these wonderful series of very funny incidents that happened to me with cockroaches. At the same time, I'm weaving a narrative exploring racism and prejudice, not just in South Louisiana, but also in the police department, and also the part that's the most uncomfortable for me is my own prejudice and racism while I was a police officer. So it's both a funny essay and a very serious essay, and it's something I don't think I could do in fiction. It's very important to me that I explore my own culpability in that area.
Mm. So it's a little bit maybe like the work of Anna Deavere Smith?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, it's more along the lines, because it is memoir of, Ricky Bragg's All Over But the Shouting, or there's so many wonderful nonfiction writers out there. Barry Lopez, Terry Tempest Williams, who work with nature, but it's themselves in relation to nature. So creative nonfiction is kind of yourself in relation to an idea and events.
Do you ever see yourself, you have a background in theater, you studied theater.
Yes.
Do you ever see yourself bringing some of your stories to the stage in a monologue?
Several people have asked me that. I don't right now, although I enjoy reading my work a great deal. I have so many other things. It's hard for me to see beyond the novel and the memoir at this point. You know, it's like, sure, maybe down the road, but, you know. Life is, I'm 47, and I feel like, you know, I could go for another 100 years. There's so many things I want to do. So I certainly see it as a possibility, but it's not anything I'm thinking seriously about right now.
Yeah, you got your hands full.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Life is very full and rich.
Yeah. On the website for St. Edward's University,
yes.
You say, very nice website, by the way. You say you cannot make great writing happen. You can only prepare yourself for it to happen.
Yes.
How do you prepare yourself?
It's really a spiritual thing. I got that line from a wonderful article in The New Yorker written by someone who, I apologize, I can't remember his name, but he was writing about the author Mark Saltzman and Mark Saltzman's struggle to complete this book called Lying Awake. And you prepare yourself for it to happen by being there, showing up every day, by not forcing yourself. I read someplace recently that Elmore Leonard said when he reads his work and if it sounds too literary, he goes back and revises. In that same sense, if I read my work and it sounds like I'm trying too hard to be beautiful or lyrical or funny, if I'm trying too hard, it's going to mess up the writing. So I just kind of have to show up, be present, and do the work.
Mm. Do you read it out loud to yourself?
Absolutely. Constantly. Constantly. I need to hear it. Because for me, one of the pleasures as a reader is to pick up the rhythm and the pacing of a writer's voice or a character's voice. So as a writer, the sound of it is very important. The rhythm of it is very important to me.
Yeah. I know a reporter who, when she writes, she taps her foot along. I mean, she's in a rhythm.
Wow.
You know, it's pretty impressive to see her work.
That's wonderful.
She loves her job. Yeah, it's great fun to work with her.
Yeah.
Hey, Lori Lynn, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much. Lori Lynn Drummond. Her collection of stories is Anything You Say Can and Will Be Used Against You. It's published by HarperCollins. She's about halfway through a 25-city book tour. Later this month, she'll be in Chicago. That date, Wednesday, March 24th, 2004. March 24th, 2004, she'll be at Barbara's Books for a reading and signing. That's set for 7:30 p.m. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Actually, it's Tom Rogers this afternoon.
Oh, okay.
And for Todd, they've got business to do in the Ag office, and we'll be covering the closing market report coming up at 2:06 Central. In the interim, today's trade on the Chicago Board of Trade saw a drop in the wheat price for today. Corn ended up marginally higher. The soybean market, especially the nearby contracts, ended up sharply higher today on a bit of a technical bounce. The March wheat contract had a high today of 374, a low of 369, and it settled just about at the low, 369.5, down 4.5 on the day. May wheat had a high of 382.5, the low 376, settled at 376.25, down 5.25. July wheat had a high of 385.5, the low 379, settled at 379.75, down 4.75. The September wheat contract for this year, 388.5, the high today, the low 382.5, settled at 383.5. That's down 4.5 cents. December wheat, the high today 395.5, the low 390.5, settled this afternoon at 392, down 4.5 cents. Looking at corn, as I mentioned, rather flat through much of the day, ended on an up note. The March contract nearby, the high today 291.5, the low 287.5, settled at 290.5, up 1 on the day. May corn had a high of 299, a low of 294.5, settled at 297.75, up 2. July had a high of 302.75, the low 297.75, settled at 301.5, up 2.25 cents. September corn at a high of 297, the low 293, settled 296, up 2.5. December corn, the high 293.75 today, the low 289, settled just under the high at 293.25, down or up rather 1.25. March of 05 corn had a high today of 294.5, the low 290.5, and settled at 294, up 0.25 on the day. July of 05 corn, the high 296.5, the low 294, settled at 296, unchanged. December farside corn at a high of 267.5, the low 266, settled at 267, down 1. In the oats, March oats had a high of 154, the low 151.75, settled at 152.75, up 0.75 on the day. The May oat contract at a high of 159, the low 155, settled at 157.75, down 0.5. Nearby soybean contracts finished the day sharply higher, but the far side contracts were a bit lower at the end of trade. On the Board of Trade, March beans had a high of 942. Check that. I'm on the wrong screen. Try that again. 945 was the high for beans today. For March, the low 925.5 settled at 942. That's up 11 cents. May beans had a high of 946. The low 924 settled at 943, up 14.5 cents. July had a high of 936, a low of 909, settled at 927.75, up 13.75. Things change in the later contracts. September beans had a high of only 818, the low 802, settled 810.5, up 0.5 on the day, and the rest of the table was down. November beans had a high of 743.5, the low 730, settled at 737.75, down 2.25. January beans for next year, the high 742, the low 730.5, settle at 734.5, down 6.5 cents. And March of 05 beans at a high of 739, the low 727, settled at 730, down 8.5. In the products, March soybean meal had a high of 283.30, the low 279 even, settled at 283.10. That was up 3.10 on the day. And even higher high on the May soybean meal contract. For May, the high 285.50, the low 280, settled at 285.30, up 4 even on the day. March soybean oil had a high today of 33.90, the low 33 even, settled at 33.62, up 27 cents. And the May oil contract had a high of 33.76, the low 32.87, settled at 33.50. That was up 47. The cattle market finished the day higher, but some big losses in hogs on the Mercantile Exchange today. Celeste Quinn has those numbers.
Thanks, Tom. March feeder cattle, 87.80, the high, 85.60, the low, 87.75, the settlement, that up 25. April, 86.60, the high, 84.20, the low, 86.37 and a half, the settlement, that up 20. May, 87.60, the high, 84.90, the low, 87.42 and a half, the settlement, that up 10. August, 89 even, the high, 87.50, the low, 89 even, the final price, that up 10. March, live cattle, 82.50, the high today, the low, 78.37 and a half was the low today for March live cattle. March live cattle finished at 81 even, that up 150. April, 78.40, the high, 75.70, the low, 78.32 and a half, the settlement, that up 75. June, 73.80, the high, 71.50, the low, 73.75, the settlement, that up 17 and a half. August live cattle, 74.10, the high, 72.65, the low, the settlement, 74.02 and a half, that up 2.5. April lean hog, 62.20, the high, 60.82 and a half, the low, 60.90, the settlement, that down 192 and a half. May, 62.20, the high, 60.30, the low, 60.80, the settlement, that down 147 and a half. June, 67.05, the high, 65.85, the low, 66.32 and a half, the settlement, that down 142 and a half. July lean hog, 63.50, the high, 61.80, the low. The final price, 62.72 and a half, that down 87 and a half. March pork bellies, 97 even the high, 95.25 the low, 96.40 the settlement, that down 115. May, 98.20 the high, 96.70 the low, 97.67 and a half the final price today, that down 102 and a half. The Dow is currently up 4 points at 10,596. The NASDAQ is 5 lower at 20.35. The S&P 500 is down 2 at 11.51.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Barbara Stanbro from Tigard, Oregon writes, "Dear Dr. Science, I know what a nook is, but what exactly is a cranny?"
When nuns leave the convent in order to find out just what they've been missing, it takes them about 2 weeks to realize the answer is not much. At that point, they become disillusioned, cranky, and irritable. If Mother Superior won't let them back in, she wags her finger at them, crying, "Nook, nook." And these women are forced to exist as shadowy characters called crannies. Now, these aren't to be confused with the Eastern European crannies, which are small carts drawn by teams of trained weasels.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.